You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Michael Steinberg. He is an art advisor and also a publisher of limited edition prints. He lives and works in New York. Michael, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let's talk about art advisory and some of the things that you're involved in. I mean, I'm also interested in your gallery experience, but what caused you to make the transition between moving between a brick-and-mortar gallery and an art advisory?
Well, a couple of things. One was a health issue, actual planned heart surgery, which was successful, but I had to be away from the gallery for a period of months. And during that period, I thought a lot about the status of mid-scale galleries in the world in which we live, and I felt that it was a more and more difficult and less satisfying role. And, you know, I've been involved in the gallery world with some breaks since I was 16, going back to 1963, when I got a job in a gallery in high school. And I just, you know, felt it was time for a change. It was, somewhat after the financial crisis, it started to take some toll. And it just was... not feeling rewarding at the, not financially, but even emotionally, not feeling rewarding at that particular moment. And I decided to give myself a little more freedom in terms of my own time. And
which meant you were continuing to publish limited editions, but you were the art advisory is essentially then working privately with clients?
Throughout... the last period of my art career, I've worked with private clients helping to build collections, sometimes with people who were serious collectors and other times with people who came to me through architects and designers who wanted art of quality but sometimes would buy significant works, but their goal was really part of fitting out a new home rather than going to the to what I remember once a client saying to me, okay, we've found work for all the walls that required works of art. Am I now a collector? I said, do you have a warehouse yet? And when she said no, I said, well, you're not quite there.
Well, that's interesting because collecting isn't, you know, which is a good point to make, isn't about simply putting work on the walls. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what does define a collector? Because essentially, it's a vast collection and a vision, I would imagine, that extends way beyond there.
Think, you know, for me, the collecting in that sense is a commitment to a period, to a theme, to particular artists, and it goes beyond the thought of, my house and my status in life and my home require the walls have a certain level of art. I'm going, whether or not I have space physically to accommodate things in my home, I'm out there looking, I'm out there buying. I'm deeply engaged in the process of acquisition.
So when you acquire, do you personally acquire work yourself for your own collection?
I do. I try to limit it. I try not to. on a certain level, I go out and say, okay, I own a lot of art at this point in my life. Perhaps on a certain level in my fantasies about myself as a minimalist, I should be thinking about deaccessioning. But it does occur that I do acquire things sporadically at this point in my life.
And do you have a warehouse?
I do.
So,
which frustrates me. It's my least favorite bill.
Right, I imagine. So that's very interesting. When you're working with other clients, you're building a collection for them. Are you also selling them portions of your collection, or it's completely wrapped around their kind of vision of what a collection should be?
Yeah, I think when I'm working with other clients, it's almost exclusively about acquiring works of living artists in the primary market. I have a lot of respect for dealers who have made the commitment to work with emerging artists, and sometimes, the artists who have emerged but who are living and working. I'm not deeply involved in the secondary market. Occasionally when a client has a specific request for something that's, been around for a while. I worked a number of years ago on a major pulp art collection, largely because it's the period that I love and it's the period in which I grew up. But the most satisfying work is uncovering younger artists. I think the social value of working with living artists is significant to me. If any of our work has social value, that feels like part of it to me. And so that's my primary area of activity. I rarely sell things that I've acquired for myself. I mean, on one occasion I sold something that had achieved significant value, and I had two children. I have two children, and there was one painting. And although they both loved it, I felt it was time, rather than for it to be an issue later in life.
Right.
And I'm personally more comfortable living in general with younger things that feel alive and current. And
so tell me, how do you, when you go out to look at artists, where do you go and how do you end up acquiring work? Just on a personal level, especially from emerging artists, I think that's an interesting process, because as someone who's also an art advisor, you're purchasing in a way that that most people don't bring the same sophistication to. So I'm curious, how do you look around and find out?
Yeah, I do. I spend a lot of time in the galleries. I'm on the boards of a couple of not-for-profits that deal exclusively with emerging art, Smackmillan and Dumbo, and an organization called No Longer Empty, which creates site-specific work in interesting locations. So I come into contact with a lot of art that way. Going to the galleries, on occasion going to the MFA shows, recommendations by other artists or other advisors or dealers who I know and respect. It's essentially about continuously looking. And I have to say, it's work that I usually don't complain about. This winter was a bit rough in New York because the weather was so bad, so I perhaps didn't get out as much as I should have. But it's about keeping your eyes and ears open.
And, that's interesting. I'd like to hear how, especially with all your experience in the world and being cognizant also of, as you said at the beginning of this interview, that the kind of shift you made and heart surgery that seems to be a very sobering, I would imagine, and powerful kind of transition in life to see exactly what it is that you want to pursue. And perhaps I'm reading into it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm wondering, as you are looking for art or exploring different kinds of artists, do you see things in terms of what artists are doing right or wrong? And I don't mean in terms of visual media, but there's a coming from not necessarily a university point of view like this radio, but artists are dying to get into the market. There's this hunger right out of an MFA. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, this kind of back and forth about whether they're in the market, not in the market. And, sure. Artists generally, no matter whether they're in the market or not, from all that I've interviewed, want to sell more things. No matter where they are, you must have seen enormous changes in the world in terms of how artists present themselves. So from your position now, and as you do studio visits and everything else, is there something that becomes more attractive to you beyond the work itself? And is there something that makes you kind of wince a little bit?
Well, I mean, I feel sometimes, like the kind of person I used to parody, who takes a negative attitude towards certain towards current things, and I try to keep an open mind. But I do these days experience, and sometimes I get into trouble for saying this, a kind of commitment to marketability rather, and a kind of professionalism. You know, I said to someone the other day, there are moments when I have a sense that you think about some art you see and you think, well, this was someone who was in university and was looking at careers and, you know, said, oh, dental school, medical school, art school, and art felt maybe a little sexier and you didn't have to do math and chemistry, and went in that direction knowing that it had the possibility of being a remunerative career. Now, I also have, you know, enough historic sense to understand that that's unfair in a certain level, because until the 19th century, artists were essentially workmen for hire. You know, no one was making paintings out of the desire, purely out of a desire to make paintings. They were professionals with apprentices and workshops and a clientele. Things took place within their work. They transformed, you know, we went from, you know, icon-like flat Byzantine painting to perspective in the Renaissance. But, you know, until you get to the 19th century, this image of the artist as a free being driven to make work that he felt driven to make out of a need of personal expression, and which was certainly a kind of dominant theme in the 20th century. There are moments when I feel that's disappeared, and we're looking at art that was made for the market. When I went back into the gallery world, you know, I'd been involved in it very young. I left it, went back. When I reopened a gallery under my own name in early 2000, that's 2002, I think. One of the first things I noticed when clients came to the gallery, almost invariably, the first question people asked was, where did the artist go to school? And for me, this was almost shocking, because it was, you know, early in my gallery life, no one asked, no one really cared. But there was a sense that that mark of professionalism and a kind of, ironically, I'm speaking to someone at Yale, you know, Yale 1998 forward was a selling point. And I remember saying to an artist who had a Yale MFA from a slightly earlier period, would it be okay if we make a typo in your resume? Because 98 is hotter than 88. It sounds almost crazy, but there was this, you know, because of the volume of work that is being produced and available to see. Also because we were beyond the period of a dominant canon, so it wasn't like in the 60s, you know, early 60s, you needed to be buying pop, you know, 70s, you needed to be buying minimal, early, you know, later on, whatever, you know, there was no sort of dominant theme that people could, or category that people could easily seek out, and work was so diverse that people were looking for other sources of guidance, and one of them, for an extraordinary number of clients in my experience during the gallery, was this sort of being able to have that seal of approval of being an MFA graduate of a particularly admired school. That was one of the first sort of indicators of a kind of shift towards a kind of professionalism that we hadn't experienced previously. On the other side of that, sometimes, you know, I'll talk to a dealer my age or, you know, older, and you'll hear this sort of complaint about artists being, you know, almost an objection to the artist's professionalism, and, you know, and there were aspects of it that were extremely positive, you know, where, you know, if artists had, you know, work with computers and JPEGs and assistants able to organize their archives, able to deliver information in an orderly way where, you know, sort of attitudinally that was not acceptable earlier in the 60s. You know, you were sort of committed to chaos. I always experienced that as a positive thing. You know, when I first worked in the gallery world, the dealer artist relationship was almost invariably on at the end of the day adversarial and parental, and you know, sort of dominating parent and unruly child, and that went through the financial arrangements, through the attitude about how work was treated, where it was shown, when it was shown, and I think the shift away to so that as the artist dealer, as the certain artists emerged into figures of real power and started to recognize their power, that shifted. But also in general, I think across the board, there's a more adult to adult relationship which emerged out of this increasing professionalism, both on certain levels on the dealer side. I mean, when I grew up, there were no dealers with MBAs or who had gone through schools of the museum or arts administration. That, you know, dealers were sort of like, including ones who are now legendary names, you know, were sort of out of the same tradition of French antiques dealers. You know, you sort of got a job in the gallery somehow, somewhere, some occasionally there are people with an absolute passion for art, but there was not, on both sides, there was not that level of a kind of professional standards and behavior. And some of that's positive, and on the other hand, some of it contradicts our romantic image of who an artist is and what you know what the art world consists of. I think also
right.
That,
I'm sorry. Because, go on.
You know, we grew up, you know, in my generation, we grew up with this image of an artist as someone who had a deep need to express certain things and searched ways to do it, you know, whether it be in terms of medium, in terms of abstraction. You know, there was an emotional, philosophical, and aesthetic commitment to both to a way of living and to a way of working. And there are levels on which I don't perceive that often today, and it's an overgeneralization. I still, you know, I do still see work which moves me, where people have taken risks to create that express that kind of passion. But I do often experience a sense of, you know, this is a career choice. I've learned certain ways to do things at certain schools, and I'm and this is my work.
And what would be the antidote to that? Because of course that makes sense. You know, when you know, I've heard very opposing points of view in doing interviews, and really you can say anything you want here. But when I talked with Robert Storr, the dean of Yale, he talked about the MFA program, which I was challenging as being part of how an artist learns to network. When I talked with Steve Rand, who, you know, runs Apex Art in the city, who's coming from a very different perspective, he said, you know, that's a corporate attitude. You know, we got to network to get somewhere. You got to get in the market. And he has an attitude very similar to yours, Steve Rand. What would be the kind of, and to me, I side with that. That makes more sense to me, this kind of excessive professionalism, this lack of risk-taking, you know, to my mind also ends up being more mediocre art, right? Because artists aren't necessarily articulating their questions, their vision, but literally trying to make products, if I'm understanding it correctly. So what would be, and perhaps it comes, this feeds into why you would buy a particular work of art for yourself.
Okay.
What would be
the antidote to that?
What should artists do to not, or could they do, to not feed into that kind of world?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because in a certain way, I think an artist has two jobs. One is to make his work, and the other is to get it seen. You know, if we think of it as a form of communication, if it sits unseen in a studio, the work has failed. And so there, in a sense, there is. I'm not opposed to networking. I'm opposed to networking as the sole act, as the principal activity. I think of an unpublished writer. You know, which at some point in my life, writing felt like a calling to me, and I said the experience of being an unpublished writer is like being on a tightrope without a net in an empty theater. And you get halfway across and you think to myself, what the hell am I doing here? So in any form of communication that you're involved in, if you're making paintings and no sculptures, video, and no one's seeing them, the question, what the hell am I doing here, arises. And so that other part of the work, which is in a world in which, you know, I mean, at one point I think someone said to me there were 60,000 working artists in New York. You know, the other, if you believe in your work, the other part of it's important. It's just a question of where the balance lies. I'll talk about the only two sort of large works that I've acquired in the last 2 years. One by a photographer named Richard Moss with an Ian, I think it's Mosse, who's Jack Shainman shows in New York, and their photographs shot in one of the Congos. And while there are things that look at first glance as landscapes of extraordinary beauty, at the end of the day, they're about the civil wars. They were shot with a military surveillance film, which gives them this strange hallucinatory color. If you look carefully at the landscape in the distance, you see the refugee camps. And so there's, for me, even though there are moments in which I, adore abstract painting, I own abstract painting, I have friends who are abstract painters, there is a level on which I'm these days increasingly drawn to things that engage contentually with the world. And I think when I look at the condition of the world these days, it becomes more important to me. The second thing I've bought recently of scale and significance, I don't know if you've come across a collective called the Propeller Group. I think two of the members are Vietnamese, and the third, I think, is Californian. And I walked in to see a show at Lombard Fried Gallery in New York, and I was at first kind of completely puzzled by what I was looking at, and then spent some time with it. And what in this particular show, they had acquired on eBay Soviet realist paintings, portraits of Lenin. And there's a backstory to this, which I'm not remembering. And then they took these portraits of Lenin, untouched, to Vietnam. And because of some connection that they had read, come across somewhere, and also because for visual reasons, they had craftspeople in Vietnam embroider into these paintings facial or skull hair of hair on the top of different roles of Leonardo DiCaprio. And so you look at this thing and you say, oh, I know who this is. And then you sort of back away and say, wait, is this Lenin? No, is this Leonardo DiCaprio? And it does this really fascinating kind of riff on questions of media, perception, history. And, you know, suddenly you're forced to think there are probably more people in the world who know Leonardo DiCaprio than Lenin. I mean, they're objects which fascinate me, both for the engagement with history, for what they do aesthetically. And the one I own is Lenin and Leonardo as the Great Gatsby. And so that's something that reached me. It also, I grew up in a very radical household. My parents were Communist Party members, so I have a lot of sentiment towards that history as well. And so I think that partially played into why this body of work appealed to me so deeply. But it's, you know, things that are, you know, artists like Fred Wilson, artists like Boltanski, someone like Dario Robleto, you know, people who Kiefer, people who are engaged in memory, history, event, are increasingly important to me.
And those are, I mean, the ones you just mentioned are, of course, major artists that are mostly in the secondary market now, right?
Well,
Boltanski, Kiefer,
well,
I mean, those.
Well, they still, I mean, they're not works that Boltanski and Kiefer are not people I sell with any. They're, I mean, they're at a price level that, you know, certainly Kiefer beyond the level of most of the kinds of clients I generally deal with. And they're not works that many people live with comfortably, except in the world of very deep and serious collecting. But, you know, Fred Wilson, Dario Robleto, they're still living and working artists. I mean,
right.
So it's on a certain, yeah, no, you know, I don't think the work is primarily in the secondary market, even for someone Boltanski's age. I guess it's probably close to 80 now, if not more.
Let's talk in closing about your publishing.
Okay.
I know you published for a while, and you published work of emerging artists as well as many artists who I recognize. How does that work? And you can say whatever you like about that, but I'm just interested in
sure.
how that began.
Well, my earliest gallery work was in a gallery that dealt essentially with it was Picasso, Henry Moore, Miro, the Surrealist, and what was then contemporary Mexican art, Orozco and Rivera, Orozco and Siqueiros. And particularly from the School of Paris, I mean, when I first went to work for a gallery, Picasso was publishing, and Miro was publishing, and we dealt a lot with these new. And I became very fascinated by it, and when I later became engaged with emerging artists, I became very interested in the involvement as a publisher. And for me, what it's meant is looking at a body of work, seeing if there's something inherent in the work that would make the thought of an involvement with prints interesting, which to my mind meant something beyond simply reproducing, but that there's something within the way the artist works and thinks that would translate into a particular media. And then try to pair the artist with a compatible printer. And then, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, a lot of that work, if you're not in a physical space, there are very good print fairs around the world. And what I like about the print fairs is because it's a very particular involvement and body, there's a level of connoisseurship and expertise and passion about the media that is sometimes not so evident in Art Basel, the major heavy money fairs, and you're dealing with, you know, smaller numbers in general, and with a kind of passionate collector in it often. I mean, you do have people who are buying simply for the image, and it's the level that they can afford, but there is a print collector mentality, which is slightly different. I'll talk about two projects that I'm about to begin. I had come across a book of short stories, of Russian short stories, a few years ago, and it started with Pushkin's story, The Queen of Spades, and I realized, you know, I think of myself as a civilized, literate person, and Pushkin is for Russia what Shakespeare is for us, and I had never read a word, and so I picked up this book, I read the introduction, and one thing that struck me immediately was that the translator mentioned that Pushkin had African ancestry. His great-grandfather had been a slave adopted by one of the czars, and I think Henry Louis Gates at one point made this sort of political, perhaps slightly ironic attempt to have the Pushkin archive at Harvard moved from Russian studies to African studies. But in any case, I read that. I read this introduction, then I read the story, which is a very fascinating story with a very famous name. And I started to think, and also, you know, having grown up in the South Bronx in the 50s and 60s, just thinking about slang, both queen and spade had certain resonance in terms of identity and in the universe. And I started, you know, I've worked with artists like, I've published Kehinde Wiley, I've published Lyle Ashton Harris, and I thought it would be a very interesting project to approach Afro-American artists, essentially, to respond either to Pushkin's racial identity, the story itself, or to the kind of slang resonance, and to create a series of images of their choosing to whichever aspect of this sort of, what struck me as this odd constellation of thoughts about this particular piece of writing. And so I've approached a number of artists. The first one who's at work is Derek Adams, who's an artist I admire a great deal. It's a matter of timing, partially, that he's the first one available. So that's a project that hopefully will get seen at the Editions on Artist Book Fair in November here in New York. And I'm more and more interested, you know, at, you know, when I first came back into this world, let's say around 2000, started publishing, you know, I published Inka Essenhage, Shazia Sikander, Carol Dunham, and, you know, prints that I'm very proud to have been involved with. But as I'm approaching it now, I'm much more interested in doing things that, you know, attach themselves to issues of history and content in a somewhat different way. So that's one of the appeals of this Pushkin project for me. And the other thing that's just about to begin, someone introduced me to a Russian immigrant artist who lives in the United States named Yevgeny Fix, F-I-K-S. And this is just in formation right now, but it's going to be a look at surveillance, a sort of comparison of surveillance pictures both by the KGB and the CIA of known homosexual cruising sites that for both the KGB and the CIA were places where you could identify people as security risks because of their homosexuality. And visually, the similarities are quite striking. So there are public bathrooms, places in parks, Moscow, Washington, New York. And when you compare the CIA photograph to the KGB photograph, they're nearly identical. And, you know, this the kind of archaicism of the thinking that motivated this kind of surveillance was to me very fascinating. And so that's the second major project that I'm...
Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.